Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Disrespect welcomes Simon Black, a researcher at York University and the City University of New York, and a visiting Fulbright Fellow at the City University of New York. Simon, welcome.
Great, Jeff. Thanks. Glad to be back.
You offered to talk about the G20 meeting and the riots that occurred there, including the death of one man who apparently wasn't even involved.
Yeah, he was just walking home from work and got caught up in the melee. The Guardian newspaper, which is available online at guardian.co.uk, has done some great coverage of this, and not only the death of that particular man.
Where's the video? Is it Guardian?
It's online. You can get it online at the Guardian's website.
All right.
And that video was released maybe a week or 2 weeks ago, and they've since released a series of videos that were posted today on their website that have documented different incidences of police brutality during the G20 protests. So that one incident wasn't isolated.
It seems to be a kind of class warfare there. I mean, the police here get various instructions, go easy, get those effing Indians out of the park. And they seem to follow instructions for the most part. But in Britain, there seems to be no love lost.
No, there doesn't seem to be. Anyone who's old enough to remember the miner strikes of 1984, 85 will know that the police were basically given carte blanche by not only the government and the government of Margaret Thatcher, but also by the special services, MI5. I don't know which one. One of them does foreign, one of them does domestic, MI5 and MI6.
Right.
Was involved in not only what they call when protesters are actually sent in to provoke, who are posing as protesters, agents provocateurs.
So one of those agencies provided agents provocateurs?
Right, amongst the striking miners.
Oh no!
And a lot of the unrest that came from the mining dispute, was not only sparked just by the confrontation between the police and the miners, and the miners standing up against the closure of the pits that Thatcher was so intent on carrying out, but also the Asian provocateurs being infiltrating the miners' ranks, and it was kept hush, of course. And a couple of good journalists, I think one worked for The Independent and one for The Guardian, which I previously mentioned, unearthed it in the kind of mid-90s or so. Very little was done, though, to crack down on the agencies involved and police involved, but this sort of thing then, and the treatment of protesters and the response to the unrest at the G20 is not unusual for the British police.
Is there any indication of agents provocateurs at the G20?
I'm sure there's something, protesters blogging or writing on independent media websites will claim that there has been, and I don't doubt that there were, but nothing's been proven thus far.
But the culmination of it is this police vindictiveness towards a man who was doing absolutely nothing with the riot but trying to get around it and home for dinner.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And with the wave of unrest that's spreading throughout the world, whether it's in the industrialized north or the global south, police tactics are going to be called into question, as they should be, because lot of very angry people, as there already are, but the, you know, the ranks of the unemployed are going to continue to grow as we fall deeper into this recession and possibly depression. So the police tactics are definitely going to be in question.
Brazil and China aside, the commentary that I'm seeing is that the third world is likely to be slower coming out of it, too, than the developed world. And the developed world still hasn't seen the light at the end of the tunnel.
Right. I mean, a lot of people in the developed world and, you know, economists who are familiar with the developed world will say that they've been in crisis for generations now.
Yeah.
This is nothing new. But there are going to be a tremendous amount of jobs lost in places that that export to the north. As demand goes down, consumer demand declines.
Yeah.
As we enter recession in the north, you know, demand for goods produced in places like China and Brazil and Mexico will go down, and you'll see layoffs across the global south and a number of sectors.
Brazil and China are trying to make moves to stimulate domestic consumption. I don't know. China's probably going to be more successful there because of their population base than Brazil with their dependence on commodity exports.
Right.
I saw some disturbing news about India getting deeper into it in the paper just the other day and didn't have, I think it was yesterday, and didn't have time to read it. But I just thought, oh, no, you know, India is one of the bright lights too.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the important thing for your listeners and anybody who's really trying to think through what's happening in the economy and people's response to it is to provide the necessary historical context. We really have to look back to around at least 1973.
Okay.
To see the overthrow of Salvador Allende in Chile and his socialist regime there.
Yeah.
And the with the help of the CIA, General Pinochet coming to power, and that's when you really have a clear break between the way economies and the way societies were organized prior to that and the way they've been organized since, which has gone under the name of neoliberalism, that kind of political and economic project that's been intent on cutting back social services, combating trade unions. It's led to increasing inequality and poverty across the world, not only in the north.
Quote, disappearances, unquote. Was there any South American country that was untouched by the policy of making people who the state did not favor disappear?
No. The only exception might be Cuba.
Yeah.
But the resistance that people mounted towards this shift in the economies and politics towards neoliberalism.
Yeah.
Neoliberalism, by its very definition, freeing up the markets, but as a great academic and a British academic, Stuart Hall, once said, the markets are to be free, but the people are to be disciplined under neoliberalism.
Yeah.
And that's what you saw across Latin America. You saw the markets being freed up. This is a deregulation of the financial markets, of the labor market, etc. But you saw the people were disciplined, and often disciplined very, very brutally. And as they have been disciplined in Canada as well, trade unions have lost their collective bargaining rights in many ways. The recent attempt by the Harper government, prior to the threat of the coalition toppling him, to restrict the rights of public sector workers to go on strike is just a further example of how neoliberalism hasn't left the workers of the North untouched.
No. No, and supported to varying degrees by American-based multinationals, both at home and more recognizably abroad. I'm thinking of Coca-Cola now, but there are other examples as well.
Oh, yeah. There's many multinationals, whether they're operating in Nigeria or like Coca-Cola, who are in Colombia and have been found to be hiring death squads to take care of, as they say, their trade unionists who are organizing their factories. There's been no shortage of brutality by multinational corporations who are intent on maximizing profits and minimizing any resistance towards that goal.
How do you see the the G20 riots fitting into this. There does seem to be a real divide in British society, and it doesn't seem to be. There seems to be no effort to bring the two sides together. I say two sides because they're not officially two sides, but they're very clearly two sides. When the police look at the opportunity presented by a man whose back is turned as an opportunity to do violence to someone, regardless of what their own actions are.
I think that will spark further interest by people who may not have been sympathetic to the protesters' demand in the first place. The fact that
it could be you
who wasn't involved in the protests actually, was subject to police brutality.
Yeah, you might not sympathize with the protesters. Better watch your way on the way home from work, sort of thing.
Right. There was a really interesting report that came out by the head of the Metropolitan London Police, which warned that of a wave of protest and civil unrest in Britain that would spread into the middle classes, not just amongst workers and the poor, but amongst people who previously would not be involved in street protests.
And this was a police administrator?
This was a police administrator, and the report was covered in the British press, more so in the kind of left liberal press like the Guardian and the Independent and the Daily Mirror than in the right wing press.
Yeah.
And he was very clear that if this crisis continues to unfold the way it seems to be, and if governments aren't quick to respond to it in a way that will shore up jobs and incomes amongst the great majority of the population, that there is going to be unrest, and that unrest will spread into social classes who previously would not think of engaging in street protests or strikes or what have you. A similar report came out of the IMF itself, which is the current chief of the IMF, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, also made a clear statement around the time of the G20 meeting that if governments don't respond appropriately, there is going to be unrest and there will be mass unrest. And he should know because riots in the global south have occurred throughout the 1990s against IMF policies, and very little reporting has been done on them, at least amongst the Western media.
Yeah. Yeah, well, to my mind, these are people who are not used to being without power, and the idea, the recognition that they may be being deprived of power, even as they are deprived of the supports they count on, their income, their family, their the goodwill of their communities, might lead them to think that their traditional courses of action, such as showing up at the voting booth, are not enough anymore. And that doesn't bode well for Western democracy.
In what way, though?
Well, if you think you have power, you're middle class,
right,
and you see your income under attack, but you're fighting it, and you're fighting a holding action, you're not winning, but you're slowing down the government's eating into your income and so forth, and all of a sudden your job is gone, and the government effectively is saying, I don't know what we can do for you, but, we got big bucks for the car makers and the banks, but for you, I think you better get in line. Then, you suddenly you see yourself disenfranchised from society. It's not a position you're used to seeing. And your response to it normally would be to return to the voting booth. But are you going to wait another 2, 3, 4 years before you have your say?
Right.
And you feel yourself unjustly disenfranchised, too. It's not as if you say, I bought into this system. I knew this day could come, so I don't have a family anymore. So I don't have a car or a job anymore. So I don't know where my next meal or shelter is going to come from 6 months from now. That's fair. I bought into it. I can't see that happening. I don't see it at all. And I don't see them waiting to show up at the voting booth. And I don't see them writing letters to their MPs either. It looks pretty grim from this point of view, from my point of view.
I think it could go two ways. You could get people who are a mass of people who are alienated from the political and economic system, or like you had in the 1930s in the U.S., I'll just use the U.S. because that's, I'm speaking from New York, and I'm seeing some of the actions that are taking place in New York City right now, you could have a reinvigoration of democracy in the sense that
grassroots
people, grassroots democracy, not just the type of democracy that the people in power like to keep us to, which is, like you said, showing up at the voting booth, and in the United States you vote for two parties of big business, one's red and one's blue.
Right.
And if you have that reinvigoration of democracy, and I think there's signs that you're going to see that because you have the return of the sit-down strikes, which were so common in the 1930s, where this is where trade unions were first recognized by the government, and they recognized their right to collectively bargain for their members. The great sit-down strikes in Flint, Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
1936 with General Motors,
oh,
which led to the establishment of the and the recognition of the UAW.
Oh.
And you fast forward to 2008 in December, you're seeing workers at the Republic Windows and Doors factory in Chicago sitting down at their plant and refusing to leave until they're paid their appropriate severance and vacation pay.
Did it work?
And it worked. In the 1930s, you had rent strikes where people who could no longer afford to pay their rent because of the Great Depression, they were unemployed, would not pay their rent, stay in their homes, and when the police came around to evict them,
yep,
you would see a spontaneous eruption on the streets, and people would come out of their homes to defend the evicted family.
Really?
Often you had Socialist Party and Communist Party cadres who were involved in doing this, and they would put themselves on the outer circle so they would absorb the first blows from the police to try to evict the family.
Really?
And now today, again, fast forward to 2008, 2009, and you have groups like ACORN, which is a community organization across the United States and very active in New York City. They're currently carrying out a campaign which is preventing sheriffs from evicting people from homes that have been foreclosed.
Really?
Yeah.
How are they achieving that?
Just with numbers? A lot of this goes under the radar. It's it's called the Home Savers. I think it's called the Home Savers Campaign or Home Defenders Campaign. Sorry.
There does seem to be I hate to use the word conspiracy. There does seem to be an acceptance by the media that if they don't broadcast the success of deprived or oppressed people, that there's likely to be less success and more order in society. And I find that disturbing in something that we call a free press.
Right. Well, as you and I know, Jeff, this sort of information is dangerous stuff. And it's not exactly the thing that Rupert Murdoch wants to be putting on his front pages, that
people
defending their homes from foreclosure and
right,
beating back the sheriffs in New York City,
yeah,
or the homeless who are, you know, I had a statistic today I came across. There's currently 15,000 children in New York's homeless shelters.
No.
There's an organization called Picture the Homeless.
Really?
Which has been very active in taking over abandoned buildings and lots across New York City.
Really?
And occupying them and claiming them.
And successful.
And successful in the sense that in times of crisis, the police do show up. There's more people mobilized, but there's also public opinion shifting.
Yeah.
And if those in power, whether it be in the institutions of the police or in government or what have you, with the justice system, if those in power feel that the tide has shifted in public opinion, they're going to be more reticent to carry out the sort of acts that they would in times of you know, relative prosperity for the rest of the population.
Yeah, it's one thing to tackle a group of 150 people that nobody identifies with. It's another thing to tackle 1,500 people that everybody identifies with.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A great illustration, there was an amazing poll that came out by a well-respected public opinion pollster, the Ramison Report, which is relied upon quite heavily in the Beltway in Washington for reliable kind of public opinion surveys. There's a survey that came out last week that said only 53% of Americans felt that capitalism was a better system than socialism, and 20% preferred socialism. Under 30 year olds said 37% favored capitalism and 33% socialism.
That's what I heard. There's a demographic shift there.
This is very unusual.
In the States.
You probably haven't seen numbers like this since the 1930s.
Yeah.
When the Progressive Party and the Communist Party and the Democrats under FDR had mass support.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and they were the right-wing edge of this kind of support, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. FDR and Democrats definitely were.
Yeah. Yeah.
The statistics, it's funny, with Obama in power,
yeah.
The statistics amongst Democrats that you saw in this poll you had 30% of them favoring socialism, with only 39% of them favoring capitalism.
So what does that mean? They're undecided? They're undecided, or they're voting for the status quo, or what?
Well, the rest are undecided.
It's holy shit.
20-odd%. So,
yeah. Well, if you've got 30-some-odd and 30-some-odd, you probably have 30-odd% undecided in the middle.
Right.
Which is a huge number, and a threat to the two-party system, too.
It definitely is.
Yeah. I guess bigger than anything we've seen. Bigger than, for instance, Ross Perot or Ralph Nader have presented to date. Well, it's good news. I mean, that a different kind of democracy could be the outcome of people feeling disenfranchised and not wanting to accept the limited choices that they're given. I mean, it's certainly better than chaos. And maybe we'll begin to see an emergence of this. I mean, we already see a little bit of it in Canada with Stephen Harper pulling his party with their heels firmly dug in to the center. And he's by no means the Canadian concept of center, but he's a conservative, small c conservative concept of center for sure. And
yeah.
if he moves center, I wonder what will be left. For the traditional left, there has to be a new kind of initiative to capture votes from left-leaning voters then.
It'll be interesting, definitely, to see where Michael Ignatieff takes the Liberals in a time of economic crisis. I know that traditionally the NDP, when you have periods of high unemployment, when you have periods of general crisis, will shift to the left. Not only because its leadership recognizes that's maybe where it should be, but because the grassroots members of the NDP will raise a stink and make sure that those policies that address the crisis the way it should be addressed will filter up through the party into the leadership.
At the NDP?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
And even the Liberals, I think progressive and left-wing Liberals, will probably be pushing within that party because Ignatieff so far hasn't shown much in the way of a progressive politics.
No.
And
he strikes me as a as liberal of the right.
Coalition.
Yeah. But I wonder if Canadians, I don't know if other Canadians are getting cynical about politicians, so-called centrist politicians changing their stripes in a new electoral environment. I don't buy it. I don't know how much credibility there is for someone who appears to be pro-business, pro-trade like Ignatieff for setting up an image for himself. Certainly now is the time if he's going to try and do it. And he made a big splash today in the papers about reforming EI and making it accessible to the same degree all across Canada for every province, which it's not in Ontario. Ontarians have less access to EI than they do in the other provinces. And that kind of move, he'll have to make many of those kinds of moves to change his image with the voters. And particularly with Ontario voters who've seen a lot of hot air, but are still saddled with a decidedly right-wing Liberal government, and are getting awful tired of the talking, is the impression I'm getting. There's a lot of, the talk in the beginning about broken promises, and now the talk about no promises, and things still trucking along the same old way, and nothing being done, is the viewpoint that I keep distilling from the newspaper articles that I read on public opinion of the McGuinty liberals. So with that in mind, I can't imagine that their view of the federal liberals is going to be helped or will help the federal liberal chances. And when it dawns on them that the campaigners and the strategists are the same people for a large part, if somebody were to let that loose in well-read media or well-heard media, then it would be even tougher for someone like Ignatieff. And yet, as you say, the NDP, I don't know, you know, they shift further left. They cede more ground to the center, too.
They could do. It could be a consequence, but it depends where the populace goes as well.
Yeah,
if the populace
right.
moves to the left, then you can cede that center ground and not have to worry about it in terms of your electoral calculations. But as I see it, we've got a far ways to go yet before we have the type of mass mobilization that's going to be necessary to challenge the direction that economic elites and political elites want to take us in terms of a response to this crisis.
You want to put that in 10 words or less for me? As you see it, what was that?
As I see it, that we have quite a ways to go before we reach the point of mass mobilization where economic and political elites are going to respond to the crisis in a way that's going to address the concerns of the vast majority of people.
Do they ever, Simon? Do the economic and political elites ever respond to the masses? A good point.
Only when they're forced to.
All right. Okay. Reach the strong arm through the microphone, right, and give them the half Nelson. All right. Thanks for taking time to be with us at CFMU today and to talk to us about what the recent conflict at the G20 represents on a worldwide and a local basis.
Jeff, thanks for having me.
All right. Much appreciated.
Hey, take care.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Simon Black, researcher at York University and the City University of New York, and visiting Fulbright Fellow at the City University of New York. Talk to us about the riots at the G20 Economic Summit in England and the meaning of that summit and particularly those riots for the developed and developing world. And now for a break before our news and the second retrospective interview.
You know, Bootleg Sal used to live across town. The law went there and it closed her down. Now you can't get the stuff no more. Now you can't get that stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. You know that place on Dago Hill. The law took the gal and the liquor still. You can't get that stuff no more. Now you can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. Little Suzanne, she used to sell hair grease. She got in trouble with the chief police. Now you can't get the stuff no more. Now you can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. There go Joe with a great big knife. Somebody been messing around with his wife. Now he can't get the stuff no more. He can't get the stuff no more. No matter how he try, he can't buy, he can't get that stuff no more. On State Street, they used to give it away, but now you can't get it if you offer to pay. You can't get that stuff no more. You can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy, you can't get that stuff no more. All of the gals used to walk the street. The law done run them off his beat. Now you can't get the stuff no more. You can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy. You can't get that stuff no more. I play. You can't get the stuff no more. You can't get the stuff no more. No matter how you try, you can't buy. You can't get that stuff no more.
Welcome to Disrespect's Review of the News. We remind you, as a listener, these are not the full stories. For the stories, you have to go to the media that we credit during our review. These are overlooks of the stories that made the news in the last couple of weeks. Does poverty impair the brain? Lori Montsebratton in The Star. An American study suggesting growing up poor causes changes in the brain that impair learning is, quote, dangerous and neglect society's role in a child's success in school and later in life, says a Toronto expert on poverty and education. And by suggesting there may be a possible biological cause for intergenerational poverty, the study, quote, is just plain scary, says Jeff Kugler. The research seems to imply that poverty is somehow biological, and I think that's really dangerous, said Kugler, executive director of the Center for Urban Schooling at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. It seems what the study is saying is it's already predetermined. To measure the connection between poverty and working memory, the researchers suggested studied a group of 195 white children, half of whom grew up in poverty. The other half came from middle-income American homes. At age 17, they found the middle-income youth were able to remember an average of 9.44 items, while those who grew up in poverty had an average capacity of 8.5 items. Since chronic stress is known to affect the area of the brain responsible for working memory, the researchers also measured stress in the study group. They found higher levels of all stress factors in the children from lower-income families. Toronto child care worker Nina Locke sees how poverty erodes the chances of children in her socially disadvantaged community of Flemington Park. We see developmental and social delays in children who come from low-income families, said Locke. But it's amazing how these children catch up by the time they reach school when they get the security, routine, and structure, as well as the nutrition that high-quality child care is able to provide. Although the American research may suggest a biological link between poverty and learning, she said her experience shows intervening early with support can quickly close the gap. When we support children and help families, these differences disappear, Locke said. I've seen it firsthand. Well, you saw the news stories this week on baby Kaylee, who was taken off of life support so she could die and donate her heart to another child whose heart was in need of transplant. This is two stories, ethics tricky in transplant matter. No kidding. Stuart Laidlaw, ethics reporter at The Star. The issue of directed organ donation was raised this week after the parents of two-month-old Kaylee Wallace offered up their dying daughter's heart to save one-month-old Lillian O'Connor, whose heart can't get enough oxygen to her body. But it was not to be. Plans to transplant Kaylee's heart were put on hold Tuesday when she was taken off a respirator but continued to breathe for more than an hour. As a result, Kaylee is no longer considered a viable donor for Lillian. After Kaylee's donation to Lillian was called off, Kaylee's father wept for both babies. The emotional highs and lows in transplants are just enormous. When there's an interpersonal relationship there, it's even worse. Lillian Wright, director of bioethics at University Health Network, says allowing the families of dying patients to decide where organs will go would mean that some deserving patients may be left out. Allowing donor families to decide who gets an organ is open to abuse, since we can never know the motivations of those involved. You worry about some sort of scheme that might come up, says Margaret Somerville, a director of the McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law, some sort of payment for organs. And On the same page, Teresa Boyle, health reporter, cardiac death issue eyed closely in Canada. Canada's transplant community is closely watching the case of baby Kaylee because harvesting her heart would have marked the first such donation here by a victim of, quote, cardiac death. This case is really exceptional because heart transplants after cardiac death are extremely rare. There's really only minimal experience worldwide, said Dr. Sam Shimi, medical director of organ and tissue donations at Canadian Blood Services, said yesterday. The New England Journal of Medicine last year reported on three cardiac death transplants involving infants at Denver Children's Hospital, touching off a debate about medical ethics. In each case, the heart was removed from a newborn suffering from severe brain damage less than 2 minutes after they were taken off life support. While the heart saved terminally ill babies, questions were raised about whether the donors were really dead. Shimi estimates only about 2% of the 500 donors who have organs harvested annually in Canada have suffered cardiac deaths. The rest are brain dead. Up to 25% of donors in countries with established DCD or cardiac death transplant programs have suffered, or organ donation programs, DCD, have suffered cardiac deaths. Canada Blood Services wants more hospitals and more provinces to start taking this on as a responsibility rather than an option, which it currently is. Expediency is more of an issue in harvesting organs after cardiac death than after brain death because organs deteriorate very quickly once deprived of oxygen. They don't say what happens to the donors once deprived of their hearts. The Star again, homeless victim. Homeless man ID'd as victim of BC slang from Pettifong in Vancouver. A homeless one-legged man in a wheelchair who was well-known in an East Vancouver neighborhood was identified police as the city's 13th homicide victim of the year. Michael Nestruck, 41, was found dead Thursday by parents dropping off children at the Sir Guy Carleton Elementary in the Collingwood neighborhood. His body was on school property. NDP Health Critic Adrian Dix, who lives near the school, said the area has been dealing with homelessness and violence for the past few years. The neighborhood where immigrant and working class families have lived for decades has also seen a rise in the sex trade. These are very sad circumstances, and investigators are very upset about this tragedy, said Vancouver Constable Lindsay Houghton. Recession taking toll on the young. This from the Globe and Mail, April 13th, 2009. As parents lose jobs, demand soars for mental health services for children in hard-hit Windsor. The number of children and adolescents suffering mental health problems is soaring, and no place knows it better than Windsor. This by Andre Picard, the public health reporter for the Globe. New data out of Windsor, an auto town hit early and hard by the recession, show that demand for mental health services jumped 50% last year. There's also anecdotal evidence that this increase has continued unabated as the local economy sputters, a portent of things to come across the country. The Windsor Regional Children's Center seen referrals jump 50% in 2009 compared to a similar period in 2008, while the number of young people coming into the walk-in clinic for help has doubled. At another agency that deals with the most severe cases, children and adolescents who are suicidal, the number admitted has nearly tripled to 27 young people a month from an average of 10 before the downturn. In that period, nothing has changed except the economy, Connie Martin, executive director of Maryvale Adolescent and Family Services, said in an interview. RCMP used 5 shots with taser on 16 people. This from the Star. Ottawa, the Canadian Press. RCMP officers stunned at least 16 people 5 or more times with a taser last year, police reports say, despite the outcry over the death of Polish immigrant Robert Zakanski after he received multiple shocks. The 2008 incidents, all but one of them in Western Canada, were described in RCMP taser reports obtained by the Canadian Press and CBC Radio Canada under the Access to Information Act. The cases emerge amid questions about the risk of multiple taser stuns and calls from opposition, MPs, and civil liberty groups for police restraint, especially when it comes to repeated jolts. The incidents last year included 6 in Alberta, 4 in Saskatchewan, 3 in British Columbia, 2 in Manitoba, and 1 in Prince Edward Island. And from the Globe and Mail, Saturday, April 11th. A rude awakening. This is a long article. It probably is a whole page spanning 2 pages in an elaborate layout. What's the polite way of telling a civility expert that he's full of it? Canada is the most civil country in the world, says Binay Devishan, sounding like a man who is trying to pick a fight. Okay, so maybe we're not as deliberately rude as the French or as internationally disruptive as the pre-Obama Americans or as hostile to outsiders as the Saudis, and perhaps we even feel a twinge of regret when we resort to national stereotypes such as these just to bolster our collective self-esteem. Professor Devishan, Chair of Sociology at the University of Prince Edward Island and author of the new book called Civility, A Cultural History, says, reassuringly, I see a future that's very rosy in terms of behavior. Tellingly, it is not a quality required or sought out by administration's committees when students are chosen, precisely because it is so much harder to measure than marks. This provides us with a substantial challenge. McMaster University's Dr. Kathy Risden says, students spend half their life getting into medical school. I don't know how much a 21-year-old like this can know about civility. They don't have enough social experience or life development to have a meaningful conversation about it. So it's up to you, the patient, to teach them. Civility in these uncertain times is very much about negotiations and mediations, about gradual understanding rather than quick and easy condemnation. And that means the old-fashioned notions of right and wrong also have to disappear. You can't just say that random cell phone outbursts are rude. You have to prove it persuasively because your target audience is highly skeptical of curmudgeonly know-it-alls. And rightly so, says Richard Smith, a professor of communication at Simon Fraser University. Keep in mind, he says, that when it comes to a new device, no one knows what the rules are. They have to be worked out. It's not that manners don't matter, Professor Smith says. The lack of civility is a huge problem. But when we say that, we're not talking about a particular behavior or a kind of technology. We're talking about a lack of respect, like what the police did to Robert Zakansky at Vancouver Airport. If we're talking about the civility we want, he says, it isn't the kind where you obey authority. It's the kind where you step in and speak up as a human being. This by John Alamang, a Globe and Mail feature writer and a frequent contributor to Focus. Wrapping up, the UK at the G20 video shows officers slamming bystander on London street. This from the Star. A week after a Londoner's sudden death at a rally he apparently never wanted to be part of, his strange case is raising difficult questions for Capitol's police. Ian Tomlinson, a burly 47-year-old newspaper vendor, was trying to make his way home after work, April 1st, when he got caught up, seemingly inadvertently, in the sporadic clashes between police and protesters drawn by the Group of 20 Economic Summit. Initial autopsy reports indicated he died of a heart attack, and police said G20 protesters had hampered their attempt to revive him. The inference was that the police had nothing to do with his death. But new footage being examined by the Independent Police Complaints Commission paints a different picture, casting police in a more aggressive light. The footage, whose authenticity is not being challenged by police, shows Tomlinson walking alone with his hands in his pockets in front of a line of police officers, some with dogs and equipped with riot helmets, shields, and batons. One officer appears to lunge at Tomlinson from behind, pushing him with enough force to send him sprawling on the ground. Tomlinson is then shown sitting up before bystanders help him up. He collapsed in a nearby road minutes later. Police attempted to resuscitate him before he was taken by ambulance to hospital, where he was pronounced dead. For our next retrospective interview, did you know that BC's most severe disabilities are compensated about the same rate as Ontario's? Did you know that Alberta's recently have gone up to the same level? Here we have an interview with the MPP who backed that increase. Disrespect welcomes Alberta MLA for Strathcona, Rob Lougheed, the driving force behind Alberta's disability income program.
Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. The Premier's Council on the Status of Persons with Disabilities that Alberta has is an Alberta committee.
Right.
New Brunswick has a similar Premier's Council to advise government about disability issues. Other provinces have different mechanisms for informing the government about disability issues.
Right.
New Brunswick has been a great help to us because they have a similar kind of structure. The Premier's Council is the same. Ours was actually modeled after theirs.
Right.
And we've been following with interest the Ontario with Disabilities Act in the past, and other provinces have put together disability strategies. BC is kind of working on something. Manitoba came in with their disability strategy, different than ours, but it was Manitoba's way of dealing with some of those issues. A state in Australia, same issues. Every jurisdiction is facing the same kind of issues for persons with disabilities. We have to get together a little better on this. I brought forward a private member's bill dealing with building codes, and a fire chief in the community I happen to represent is on a national council of fire chiefs, and somebody from Ottawa is chair of it, and they have been meeting and talking about egress.
Yeah.
And it turns out they're exactly the same issues for people with disabilities, only in reverse, right? They're
reverse to what?
Trying to get out of the building instead of into the building.
Oh, of course.
And so he was really pleased about what's been happening with this barrier-free design and access, because it's a huge issue for firefighters.
Yeah.
So here we have a national group of firefighters who are involved in building code issues and advisors to the building code. They're saying, hey, we've got to get persons with disabilities and persons with knowledge about barrier-free design and access into the decision-making process so that we aren't redesigning buildings after the concrete's poured.
Right. Yeah, that's expensive.
That's a huge issue. What I think is really needed is some leadership on the federal side. Every province shouldn't be reinventing the wheel all the time.
I see.
And I really believe we need to have the feds come to the table with us and address some of these. In the last meeting we had, which was 2 years ago, there was some federal representation there, but we can do more.
So you think federal participation is the big advantage to be gained in the future?
Well, to help coordinate, so we're not all reinventing the wheel.
Right. One of the things that I noticed, and I haven't had time as we talk to look at Bill 118 yet, but I did have input into it, is that there is no disincentive to not observing accommodations for people with disabilities. In other words, for a government agency or a private business, there's no disincentive not to comply. They can postpone the cost of complying by refusing to comply, and when the decision's finally made, if it's in favor of the person with the disability, then they have the expense. And it seems that this lack of an incentive to comply with the law seems to hinder its application. Did you address that yet in Alberta? Did you see that addressed in Bill 118? Do you think that's an important component of disability accommodation?
It's a huge important component for the person with a disability who is unable to find adequate accommodations, whatever they may be, either permanent or temporary.
Right.
And one of the ways that we have been moving towards addressing it here is to evaluate, to have a proper template for the different hotels, say.
Right.
And even at that, we need to have more education of people. For example, we had a board meeting, a council meeting, and my council members came to this hotel. Well, one of the council members was told that he would have access to a lift that would be able to get him out of his wheelchair into the bed, because that's what they do. They can rent these things, and some hotels even have them.
Right.
So he was going to get this brought over to the hotel. But, the bed went down to the floor, like they do in some hotels, right?
Oh.
Instead of having space underneath to put this apparatus under the bed to work. So he had to go across. He couldn't stay with the rest of us. He had to go across the street to a hotel where the beds, in fact, had this space underneath. They were on
for the lift.
On legs instead of right to the floor.
Right.
Now, he was told that everything was fine, that the accessible hotel room was accessible.
Right.
Well, it wasn't quite, but people don't understand this. This is the huge component of education that's required. And I've noticed in the in your Bill 118, there is an attempt to address that through education. Again, I don't see it exactly in front of me here, but, you know, we've got to tell people, because they don't know.
I agree with you, and that's the mission of the show, in fact, is to educate people.
People just don't understand. It took me a long time to understand these issues. I have a friend who, big business person, very successful, got to know him about 7 years ago, and shortly after I got to know him, he complained about he's going to have to go for an MRI.
Oh.
And so fine. Next time I saw him, he's been diagnosed with MS.
Oh.
And he has progressed rapidly. And this fellow made a statement that I'll never forget. He looked at me and said, you know, Rob, there's a lot of difference between having a disability and talking about a disability. And that's the kind of understanding we're going to have to get to. One of the ladies that helped me the most was a lady who was a successful business person. One afternoon, she just finished the afternoon, the noon rush, and she was in her office, and she felt a small twinge in her back.
Oh.
30 minutes later, she was paralyzed.
Huh.
She had what they called a spinal stroke. After she went through rehab and all the rest of it, she's in her wheelchair, and she's going to her business to go back to work because she had built this business a couple years earlier, fully accessible, according to code, absolutely the state of the art, because she said, I want to have this building so people can get into it. You know, when she went up to the door, she found she couldn't get in the door. The angle of the ramp was just a little too, or the angle, the slope just in front of the door was a little too much for her to handle. She got inside and found out she couldn't get in this fully accessible washroom she thought she had.
Oh.
And so she was one of my best persons for helping to explain that, you know, we just don't understand what the issue is until we're faced with it ourselves. And if we don't all want to go through understanding on that basis, so we need people with design expertise to explain these things. We need to be able to identify these things in a better way.
So if these are part of the building code, to take an example that you've given us, does that mean that if a person builds a building and doesn't meet the code, they can be required to renovate it?
That will be part of the regulations, is my fond wish, if they don't meet the code.
Right.
I mean, if you build a building and the fire code isn't met,
right,
you're not given an occupancy permit.
Gotcha.
If
okay.
you build a building and you don't meet any part of the different kinds of codes, be they fire, electrical, structural,
right,
okay, now we have in that mix barrier-free design and access.
Right.
And if you are so foolish as to put an inaccessible building together when you're constructing this,
right,
then I guess maybe you better renovate it before you get an occupancy permit.
Okay. It's been really interesting, been really instructive to talk to you about how you gather the information and that you see this as a process rather than a fait accompli.
Well, certainly people with disabilities don't think it's done, and they're the ones that are giving us the advice, so we appreciate that help.
All right, good. Thanks, Ron.
Thanks a lot. Good luck.
All right.
So long.
Bye.
You know, back in the country, where I came from, you know, we used to dance all night long, you know, drinking homebrew and corn liquor. And, you know, we used to have set dances. We used to dance set dances. And I'm going to play a little number here. There's no words to it, but it's just a beating. But we used to start playing this. So we have the guitars and the violins and harmonicas. And we dance all night long. But it goes something like, it's called Chicken Can't Roost Too High for Me. And it goes like this. Thank you.
At the break, you heard from the Time Life History of the Blues, Tampa Red, You Can't Get That Stuff No More. And at the end of the show, from Going Down the Road Feeling Bad, Cephas and Wiggins, Chicken Can't Roost Too High for Me. That's all this week. Come back next week for Disrespect.
If you'd like to be aware a day or two in advance of what the Disrespect topic is, if we know a day or two in advance, we'll email you, but you have to email us first. Dialogue@inbox.com, dialogue@inbox.com, for your update on what's coming on Disrespect. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.